All right, good morning and welcome to the last day of applied statistics, at least in 2020. Today's program is, as you know, that we are not doing one exercise. We are doing all the exercises so far, and I will go through the project. And if you see my right eye doing strange things, it's because I've got something in it. But first, a recap of the Tuesday exercise, which was on calibration. And just quickly, the idea being that, well, you see your measurements being shifted by some amount, which depends on another observable that you have. And then you want to measure with known cases how much it's being shifted. Somehow approximate that with a function or histogram or a method for correcting it back, and then you apply that correction. And surely you should see things become better, sharper peak. And once you've corrected for one thing, then you can do it again with other effects. But you should not put calibrations on top of each other independently. You should put them sort of in a fixed order. Otherwise, it won't work as well. We plan to post the solutions for both week 4 and 5 rather soon, so you should have them over Christmas. And Marcus asks, what is the order then? Well, to some extent, it doesn't matter. You can do it in the order you like. There's no fixed recipe for that. But it's a good question, because I would generally think that you get the best result by doing it in the order of starting with the largest effect and correcting for that, and then going down. Because once you've corrected for the largest effect, the next largest becomes more sharper. And so this way you can sort of correct down. So I hope that answers your question, Marcus. Yeah, that in order, just before we dive into the projects, let me just introduce you to the last hero of the year. It's a guy we've touched upon many times. His name is Poisson. And Poisson was another French guy who was actually, he was the pupil of Laplace. Remember Laplace, who predicted black holes in 1799? And he was, he was a student of him, and he was so good that Laplace came to consider him almost a son. And he wrote more than 300 scientific papers and theses. So he was an extremely productive guy. But what he's remembered for mostly is in the very unlikely source, but he was looking into recherche sur la probabilité de jugement en matière criminelle et matière civile, research on the probability of judgment in criminal and civil matters. And here he had been playing around with the binomial, but also realized that when n got large, the binomial was very hard to sort of wiggle around, because it had the factorial in, and you quickly got lost in that. But Stirling in England had made Stirling's formula, which made approximations like of that. And he realized he could use that in the binomial under certain approximations, n large, p small. And with that, he rewrote to get the Poisson distribution. The fantastic thing being that it only has one parameter, lambda, how many we should expect. And this is, of course, what we use so often when we have a counting number of Poissonian nature. Namely, if you have a number which comes from a large underlying number with a small probability of ending where you're at, well, then the error is the square root of the number. And for small outcomes, here shown, for example, in red, it's not at all Gaussian. Once lambda is 4, well, it's hardly Gaussian, because it doesn't have this tail. But you see, already at 10, it's pretty Gaussian. And that's why the chi-square works well. Enough on that. I've said that many times. So let's jump now to today's discussion of the projects. And by now, I hope that you have all received the projects in your mail. So we have corrected them and discussed them and reevaluated and so on. And here are the results. So you should have a number of points from 0 to 100, and these weigh 20% in your overall points, which we eventually turn into a grade. But that's, due next year. So, but let's have a look at them and see what the sort of the results were and the discussions were. I'm going to put up the chat, suspecting that people will start to comment. Yeah. Okay. So here were what we evaluated on. You know, can you correctly propagate uncertainties, put necessary figures, apply the chi-square, and so on? And I already get a question, is the course passed with 50 points? That actually varies from year to year. So that depends on setting the scale. But yes, generally, I would say if you got 50 points in total, the course is passed. So, and hopefully for essentially all of you, this is your chance to sort of collect points that you put in the bank and save up for after the exam. Now, here are some comments on your projects. So we sat and discussed yesterday, summarizing, finalizing the points. And first of all, and all of this is going to sound very negative, but let's start with all the sort of general criticism points that we felt we had. Some of them fall back on me, so don't worry. One of the reasons that we're asking for a table with all final measurements was that we wanted to cross-check if you did the error propagation correctly. And I'm sorry to say, but there were actually several who failed on propagating errors correctly. Some of them probably out of sloppiness, some of them probably out of coding wrongly, but anyhow, this is an essential part of the course. And so I would, if you somehow failed there, and there should be comments in your projects, please revisit and make sure that you have this part okay. Now, another thing which is a fun, I would say almost side effect, has nothing to do with statistics. It's simply the fact that once you start a project and you get several data files and scripts and texts and in a group, then things are not as easy and you need to be organized regarding this. And I know it's not easy, but it's almost a requirement because there are several places where we could see that you were doing the right stuff. You were just quoting the wrong place or the wrong thing, shifting numbers back and forth. Not the same numbers in the abstract as you had as conclusion in your text, so on. Also, reproducibility is a stringent requirement in science. And not all reports allowed others to reproduce or recalculate the final result simply because there was no description of how they got their final results. So wonder about whether you managed to get that. And then several had missed the point about significant digits. And in the end, each experiment was to produce only one value for G. But I didn't state that clearly. I will next year. So that mistake is on me. But some of you had, four different numbers in the abstract. And I think that's too much. The reader would like to not have to take that into account, but simply, take away what you think is best. Now, also, I asked you to report the individual contributions to G. And maybe I was again not clear because I said you should state it, each contribution by itself. But in the error propagation formula, that means that many of you quoted the variance. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what I was fishing for or hoping to get was that you would state the uncertainty as if this was the only source of error. So what would the error in G be if the timing of the pendulum was the only source of error? What would the error in G be if the length measurement was the only source of error? And in that way, get the sizes. I'll come with many examples, but here's just one, right? This is because of T and this is because of length. And clearly, if somebody is to improve on this experiment, forget about the length. Focus on getting the time, the period correctly, because the length had no impact. And how do you get the overall uncertainty? Well, that in quadrature with that. So I think this is a good way of reporting errors. Some general comments. For weighted average, calculate chi-square and p-value. Thank you. You did that to an extremely large extent. So that's cool. Never combine inconsistent numbers. Again, hardly any of you did that. And people got better at saying, okay, I actually trust this and I throw this away. So that's good. Of course, sometimes, you know, if you want to make a strong argument in a paper, you probably don't show two methods that give something that's inconsistent. But it's good to have behind the scene and know what's going on. And of course, comment heavily on inconsistent numbers. Ooh. Correlations. And this is a thing to be careful about. Careful about combining correlated numbers that where you don't take the correlations into account. And what often happens is that you have two measurements of, for example, the acceleration in ball and incline. But for example, the length measurement between the gates are the same for those two measurements. And so these two G's are correlated and you don't know how much. In that case, don't use one of them. Don't combine. And then you might say, which one to choose? Probably you turned the experiment around because you wanted to measure delta theta. Well, then use that part. Or just quote in your text that you rolled down the ball many times and the variation G or acceleration was this much, very small, and that the main uncertainty comes from the position, and continue with just one number. Plan your plots and plan your tables. I think it's great ahead of time to just sit and draw what results do we have? How do we report those? Because if anything, it's the plots and tables that people read. Put results and conclusions in the abstract. It's meant for saving the reader's time. Be short and precise. Label things carefully. Always remember correct number of significant digits. I'll return to that. Yeah, right. Impact on G from each variable. We just discussed that. You don't have to put definitions of, RMS and weighted average and so on. They're considered well known. Regarding moving data. Here is a great example of four measurements of a period. And it's extremely well measured by four persons, but they're just not consistent. They're pairwise consistent. And maybe these guys measured it first and then later these, and it had too big a swing here. It's not known the reason why, but in this case, I would clearly disregard the uncertainty or even repeat the experiment because the uncertainties here are quite trustworthy. Or the last resort, simply add a systematic uncertainty. Well, revealing that you don't know what's going on in your experiment and then combine them. So specific comments on the pendulum. Well, you do many independent measurements, little systematic, and you get a very good error estimate. So when you get the period, you can get it, to 1 in 10,000 if you're really good. And at the same time, from this, from extracting the uncertainty, you can know how good you are at pushing that damn button. And many people ask, so I do a fit here. Well, actually, you can just calculate from all the residuals you have, you can just calculate the mean and the standard deviation and draw a Gaussian on top. It doesn't have to be a fit. If it is a fit, well, now you binned it and there aren't that many entries, so that might not be good. If you do an unbinned likelihood fit, that's perfectly all right, but you will also get the exact same result as taking the mean and the standard deviation. The mean and the standard deviation are actually the result, or can be, how you calculate those can be determined from the principal maximum likelihood. So they give the same. The length measurements, here there are also some systematics, and especially measuring it with two instruments made it, well, sometimes they didn't agree. Now, it's very important in this case to say the RMS, or the standard deviation here, well, that's your single measurement precision, whereas the uncertainty on the fit slope, very much smaller, is the pendulum period precision. So the, with many consecutive measurements, you can measure this very accurately. Also, the chi-square in this case simply is by construction, not, well, around 50% and not doing anything. And why is that? Well, that's because we have the chi-square here and we have the root mean square error calculation here. And if you put that into the formula, well, then you get this and this, and that means that you get a chi-square of n minus one. And in that way, you expect to get a good chi-square. And then finally, if you do single measurements between time one and time two, time three and time four, then you cannot rival this precision at all. It's the arm in it that sort of constrains it as much. And if you did it between time one and time two, and time two and time three, well, suddenly those two time intervals are not independent, but that is a small effect, admittedly. All right, for the ball on incline, the time measurements have, I would say, insignificant uncertainties. So repeating the ball down the incline doesn't help. Of course, it helps a few times to know that the timing measurements have little uncertainties. The length measurements have some uncertainties, and most of you were quite good at getting the errors right. And you see that from the fit in the acceleration. People got quite good p-values here, so that was nice. The angle measurement, this is the real challenge, because the angle with the goniometer and measuring the length and using Pythagoras or just trigonometry, well, it's good to do it in two ways because they have very different systematic uncertainties. So if one is shifted for one reason and another is shifted for another reason, well, that's not it's not really problematic. It actually helps to combine two very different methods. Did you fit the 5 points with three variables? Essentially all of you did, thank you. Did you check the chi-square? Was it okay? And did you include the results of all the fits? Often it's good to put a table with all of these things and just say, we're gonna show one fit and that's it in the text, and the rest is in the table and other plots are in the backup. But as we shall see in a moment, people had smart ways of getting around this. Why measure the angle in two different ways? Well, that is because imagine that you were measuring something that was not as simple as the angle. Well, if you can think of two ways of measuring, then use it because that's good. And we had the measurement situation, and I'm very happy. I didn't always have this slide, and I'm very happy to have made it because I think really all of you managed to get uncertainties on your measurements. I know that a few forgot to measure one thing, and well, but that doesn't touch anything in your conceptual understanding of getting uncertainties. So that's great. Specific comments, again, I think the only thing I'm really going to say here is that, well, if you swing your pendulum more than 4 degrees, then you violate the formula assumption by 1 in 1,000. So here's the expansion of the whole thing. So 7 degrees is something, but not a lot. And just some people were trying to get the period with a camera. This is from last year. And you would think that a camera is superior. This was 16 frames per second. But it was actually not that easy. They got the same sort of jitter and the same sigmas as humans got. So, of course, it can be done. But what you often need is a light gate and not just a camera. And then a question, if you combine two different methods of measuring something, both with systematic errors, do you just hope that one of the methods measured too high and the other too low? No, Marcus, thanks for the question. You hope that the two systematic errors are independent, right? Because let's say you have two different methods, but they both suffer from evaluating from the same instrument. And so if that instrument is wrong, both of these are going to be wrong. And then it's not going to help you to combine two measurements. But if one suffers from one type of error and can be too high or too low, and the other suffers from some other errors independent of this and can be too high and too low, now you can combine the two measurements in quadrature, right? You take the, and then the error goes down. And that's the point of it. I hope that explained it. So you have statistical errors. It's just like repeating a measurement. If it's not correlated with the previous measurement, then we combine the two and the error goes down like 1/√(n), where n is the number of times we repeat. But if you do it with two different types of measurements, then the systematic error that you might not know anything about, well, is going to make the error go down. And not only that, they are going to be used as a cross-check that this works at all. For the ball on incline, I would say that, well, one interesting thing is the ball size actually makes a difference. Once you get to small balls, it has a problem. It's as if friction or something else starts increasing. And no, you cannot measure angle with 0.001 degree precision. It's good to sit and think about, you know, when you state numbers and especially uncertainties, if this is really reasonable. And admittedly, this was last year that somebody reported that number and I couldn't help thinking, well, I don't think so. Now, raw data in the appendix, essentially all of you did this very well. Thank you very much. So here's just a big table with everything, but people put many small tables and that was super. And I hope they also served you well in the sense of these are the measurements we use. All right. Some discussions. There is the case of correlated measurements. And this is important to understand because once you combine correlated measurements and don't know that they're correlated, you think the error goes down, but it doesn't. So when are measurements correlated? When they are partly based on the same sub-measurement or input. And when they're measured with the same instrument repeatedly, well, they can be, they don't necessarily have to be. But if the instrument has some offset, then everybody's going to have that offset. When they're from different methods measuring the same quantity, well, here I would say they're not correlated, and this is what you should try. And when they involve commonly extracted quantities, well, if you extract both A and B, then there's a tendency for A and B to be correlated. But again, not necessarily. We'll get that in advanced fitting next year. And there's a question, if it's bad practice to combine multiple ball measurements in the same direction that use the same length measurement. Well, if they use the same direction and same length measurement, well, then then they're correlated because you use the same sub-measurement input, namely the length of the gates. So rolling two different ball size doesn't give you two different experiments. You're going to have some error common to the two, which is from the position of the gates. And so they're going to be correlated. To a degree, you don't know. So it's not even that you can correct for it. Okay, from the ball on incline. Ah, no, there's another question quick. Is correlation an issue when we use acceleration to calculate theta from the same acceleration, to get delta theta? No, here it's not a problem. In fact, here it's the smart thing to do. And I understand if it's not easy to sort of, when is it smart and when is it not great? It's not great when you combine two numbers that are correlated and it turns out that you decrease the uncertainty when you shouldn't. But in this case, we measure delta theta. And delta theta is independent of the fact that the two are correlated. But here we're using the correlation in the sense that maybe we got the acceleration wrong one way, but then we would get it equally wrong in the other direction. And delta theta doesn't care about the overall scale of the acceleration. If you look at the formula, if you took all accelerations and divided them by two, then that wouldn't change delta theta. And for that reason, it doesn't matter if there's some bias, as long as it's the same one for all the measurements. And thus, in that case, this works for us because the error on the acceleration will tend to cancel and we get delta theta with extreme precision. Cool. Good question. Thanks for asking. In the ball on incline experiment, I would say it was the gate positions that people measured nicely once, but then you reuse that measurement and you can't do much. But measuring with the goniometer many times, that was a way of reducing uncertainties because it's independent per time. You remeasure and you're not going to get the same thing. And also another case of where correlations can be to your advantage. If you have a long pendulum or any pendulum, and maybe it says on the side of the laser measure that it has a 2 millimeter precision, which means that it can be 2 millimeters off, right? And maybe that answer was 20 millimeters, who knows? But in this case, it was 2 millimeters. But if you measure the pendulum from the floor to the bottom of the pendulum and then just move it slightly and from the floor and to the ceiling where the hook is, well, then any bias in the instrument would cancel out, right? If it measured 2 millimeters too long, well, it would most likely do it on both of these. And if we assume that, well, then you can reduce the error below 2 millimeters. So that was just, you know, that's the line of thinking when people do smart experiments. Can I make the errors cancel out? All right. Now I get to my favorite part because I get to show plots from your reports. And this is always fun and fantastic. And I will show from both your reports, but also other cases. But let's start with your reports. Here is a simple and great plot. You got a nice legend of what is what. You got two scales. You got the fit, the chi-square, a probability. And you don't care too much about that. And then you got the period. Maybe an extra digit here would have been fitting, but I think the report had it. And you show the residual distribution. It looks Gaussian. Everybody's happy. And you can even see them here. Yeah, well, I quickly look. 1, 2, three, four, five, six, seven of 25 were outside one sigma. That sounds reasonable. You should expect around 1/3. Great measurement and plot. And then some people take it to the next level, because here's, I think, a super plot saying, well, we wanted to show how each of us did, and we just plotted in one go, and you could even have taken it with a bit of an offset if you want it. And then we show, you know, the individual comparisons, and here are the residuals. However, there's one funny thing with the residuals, though. As I see it, the uncertainties here have different size, and you would expect them to have the same size. So, but graphically, this is a very nice plot showing also all the parameters and so on. So, and the great thing about when you did a great graph is that you can reuse it. So here is approximately the same thing again, just now ball on incline. The different results are posted. I mean, this is really the money plot, right? This is what would go into a paper, because here you describe most things in one go. There are many other very nice plots, you know, ball and incline drawings, discussions of how do you turn the voltage into a time. And here is shown the data where people have just extrapolated, but saying, all right, it's where it passed the halfway from the top to the bottom. And the reason why I think that's a good way of doing it is that even if the ball rolled extremely slowly and it took it 2 seconds to pass on the top of it, then this is a small number. And you would expect the apparatus to come with a small timing uncertainty, because it can at every, you know, 50,000 times a second say, has the ball passed, has the ball passed, has the ball passed. So relating it to the width of this, I think should not be done. Others have tried saying, well, when it's on the top, then we take the mean, and we get an uncertainty which is related to the sharpness of this peak. So they just show it here. You could take this both on when going up and when down, going down, and the average of the two, or average of four. There are many ways of doing it. Here are more nice plots. Then here is a plot of residuals. And I think this shows why this is useful. So here are four different residuals for the pendulum. And some of them have very sharp sigmas and some of them don't. And it's very clear why this is not the case. There are measurements out on this side and none on this side. So yeah, here is a reason for why the sigma is probably large. Also here, you can see how, well, here they're on the lower side. So it's not easy to see, all right, why? Well, this makes it easy to see that there's something funny in these two. These two don't have any tails. Healthy inspection. Here is a very nice fit, but can anybody see the but here? I can say that the but lies in the residuals. All residuals are zero, large errors, exactly. Here, yeah, there are no caption. Well, there's at least, time here. Well, there is a leption. There is a caption to it as well. I just cut it out. But here, people have been estimating the residuals and clearly too large. This is in meters, and the residual is about 1 centimeter. And I would say you can tell where the gates are with better precision than 1 centimeter. But this is what was quoted, and suddenly you get a super nice fit. And in the acceleration case, you should do the chi-square, because this is exactly what tells you how well you can actually do it. In this case, you would have gotten a chi-square probability of 0.99 something, and that would have told you, you know what, we probably overestimated the uncertainties we have here. All right, here's a nice figure with zoom and text. Maybe the going up here is not necessary. And again, here's a zoom in on one point that's nice, but it also shows that probably the uncertainty in timing was too large in this measurement. So, and again, it's missing the chi-square and probability. Careful. Here are peaks that are not Gaussian, and there was not this year, but in another year, a group that simply did a fit with five Gaussians, and there was graphically very nice with colors. I would say, whoa, I also don't know how they got the chi-squares. They must have had enormous errors on the voltages and the p-values. So no, you can't just apply a peak finder here. There have been many other really nice plots through time. Here's one where people combined the voltage measurement with the acceleration fit. Nice residuals, and yeah, it works. Here's a nice plot that doesn't look like a nice plot because, well, here are the timing residuals, and clearly the person started you know, with the period off in one way and then got above and only later got good at it, you could say, or constant. And in that case, I would say I can see why it's discarded. Others tried to do nice plots, but once you put too much into it, well, they get hard to read. So I think that's worthwhile considering. Here are fits with a chi-square of the residuals. And as you can see, things can go wrong here because the chi-square doesn't feel the empty bins. And so it might do this, even if it should do something much sharper. And it happens in all four cases. So this is one of the things to be careful of. And that is why I would say if you fit the residuals, it should be an unbind likelihood fit for sure. Notice the bind likelihood would not fall into this trap because it would also be penalized. That includes the empty bins, and it would be penalized for not being low there. Here's again a great figure, but the same thing about the residuals, way too large. Great tables, error from this, error from that, combined to this. Here is a great table, and people who probably did what many of you did, namely say, well, I got one value for G and then I flipped it around and I got another value for G and I do a weighted mean of the two. But when you flip the experiment, unless you re-measure the gate positions, these two will be correlated. People did nice formulas. And here is a great case. Three different ball sizes, where for each, they show the impact on G from these. And what happens is that, well, you got some error, you got some error, and suddenly the central value shifts and you got a larger error. And what is happening? Well, you see that the impact from the ball radio and the distance of the rails goes from being very small to suddenly becoming quite large. When the ball is small, problems start arising with this and the error goes up. And the total is here. That's simply these numbers in quadrature because they're independent. Here's rejecting one point in measuring the pendulum period. Nice, and afterwards things fit. Then some people asked, is it smart to measure the pendulum when it passes in the middle of the swing, so down here, or when it's at the end, on the side? And they actually did an experiment. They said, what error do we get with each of them? And it was very clear that, you know, the bottom position where it had speed was much better than trying to get it when it's out by the side. There's a factor 3.5 difference in doing it that way. Here are issues with the number of significant digits, and it's a rare case of too few. Right, the uncertainty on the acceleration has been measured to, you know, it's a very small uncertainty, but the result has not been given with the same number of digits. So it's the uncertainty that should be decisive for which ones you use. And then here, one would say, okay, but I need the digits if you claim that you have that precision. Also, the chi-square comes out to be very small, and that's because here it's a combination of correlated accelerations, and they don't vary as much as the uncertainty. So clearly get that. And here's just one timing residual, which is completely off, right? You may reject that. But here you can see somebody, actually it's me, measured it 120 times, and it really comes out nicely Gaussian, with the exception of that one number. Probably I looked up or I wasn't, ready to see it. Now, how did you guys score? And here's the distribution of your points. And so typically you got around, I think the average was 81.5. So congratulations on that. And a few did extremely nice projects. And a few of you had some problems, and I'd very much like, well, I'd like to talk to all of you, but I think I'll give the priority to those who have questions regarding their reports. So we can do that also later today. And here are your values for G. Over here for the pendulum, and over here for the ball on incline. And this is, I would say, illuminating also. Because, well, 9.8. Okay, in the pendulum, people get 9.8. Sometimes not. And sometimes the error is extreme. Probably this is a case of where one should ask oneself, is this really what we think? Could there be a calculation error here? But errors of 0.8 or 0.2, not uncommon. And some are more than 2 orders of magnitude below. So there's an extreme degree in the results. And I don't think that just has to do with how good you are at measuring in the laboratory. So this is where we say that not all errors were correctly propagated. For the ball and incline, well, this was just a much harder measurement to do. So, again, you have values here, and many of them are close, but not all. But I think these are reasonably good. At least around 10, 9. And most of them are below 9.8, which signifies that probably there is some friction in the experiment that makes it, gives it lower values. You don't see that over here. I'm gonna skip the values of previous years and just to see this graphically. But here is how good people were in making lap times on the clock. So the lap times here is a distribution, and people said, all right, is it, you know, your reaction time? No, because you can see the pendulum coming. And I'd say 0.03 is sort of the absolute minimum, whereas some didn't hit it very accurately. But the interesting thing is this actually follows how most uncertainties typically go. There's a sharp rise at some point because you can't do it better. And then the bulk of the measurements are in the beginning, and then there's a long tail of larger uncertainties. And this is a very common thing. Interesting to see also for humans. More general considerations. I'm not going to go with those. I'm going to end with an idea. Because it turns out that when you did the pendulum measurements, especially those with long pendulums, well, you got the length right to within a millimeter. So that was 1 in 1,000 right there. and sometimes better. But the period, well, measuring by hand, you didn't get it that great. So you would probably want to improve on the period. Well, what you can do is actually to first measure the pendulum and then leave the pendulum swinging in peace and harmony, and then return to it and measure it again. And well, I tried that here. So first I have 25 measurements that I did, and I left the pendulum swinging, and then I made a cup of tea and came back a while later, and the pendulum was still swinging, and I took another 25 measurements. And I measure the period in each of these two, and I get it with quite some precision, and they agree, 1.2 sigma away, fine. And then I do a fit to all of them. And how do I do the fit? Well, I say, all right, between measurement 25 and 26, I left the experiment. So please make a jump there. And make the jump in time in units of what you get the period to be. So it's number of periods that I've left it. It's a fitting parameter, and it comes out to be 39.987 plus minus 0.008 periods. So that's, well, 1.6 sigma away from 40. As long as this number is consistent with one and only one integer, well, then you know how many periods elapsed while you left it. And so what you can do is now to do a fit and then shift the period number for the next one over, and you get an extremely accurate fit. Why? Well, that's because it's the start and the end that has the largest impact on getting the slope right. So, and here you see the various residuals. And in that way, you can get the period quite accurately. And what does that relate to in real physics? Well, I think one of the most interesting cases was actually the first observation of gravitational waves. It came about from this observatory, Arecibo in the Caribbean, which is a crater that looks exactly like a parabola shape. And so a huge radio telescope was built. It also features in James Bond and other movies. And with that, people started looking for pulsars, which had been discovered. And Joseph Taylor and Russell Hulse were two of those. And they found a pulsar that was sending signals, and they typically sent, you know, many times a second, but the period wasn't constant. Now, a pulsar is a neutron star which acts a bit like a light tower and sends out extreme radiation, and then they rotate fast. And then if Earth is in the beam where it sends out along, well, then it gets beacons. And changing the rate of rotation for a neutron star is impossible, or very, very hard, meaning it's ultra stable. It's at atomic clock precision. Now, why would they then find one which had a variation in the period? Well, that's because it was actually two neutron stars circling around each other and in a very small confined space. I'm showing it here, and this is the diameter of the sun. So most of their orbits could lie inside the sun. Now, each of these weighs more than the sun. And so here you have gravitational effects of general relativity at the largest scale. And you're so fortunate that somebody placed the equivalent of an atomic clock on one of the stars, the neutron stars, which were sending signals to us. Now, they measured it with extreme precision, and they just kept measuring. And when they didn't have funding, they could live from the principle I just showed you. They knew the period so well that it wasn't a problem. Here is their measurement of the period. It's 59 point and then 14 digit in milliseconds. I think in the end, they got to 16 digit precision. And with that, you can suddenly see all the effects. The total mass of the system, well, and you know, you measure to an extreme degree. We don't know the mass of the sun. Well, I think we know the mass of the sun, but we don't know the mass of any other star with that precision. And normally you can't know the individual masses in a binary system, but because of the relativistic effects, you can. Of course, you'd need to know the masses and the effects very accurately, but they did. And so they could get the mass of each of these with four digits. Orbital period, well, it was less than 8 hours. They got it to extreme precision, eccentricity. Look at these. And so what they then measured was that the system was losing energy and fast. And the question was how? You didn't get radiation from them. So they were not radiating light, but they were radiating maybe gravitational waves. And the output from this was like 1,000 times or 100 times the sun output. And that meant, since they weren't that far, that you should be able to see it, but there was nothing to see. So the Earth and the sun outputs about 200 watts of gravitational waves. And that means that we lose 10 to the minus 15 meter radius per day. So that's not bad. But this was losing a lot of energy. And they could plot that, the effect on the perihelion time. And then they could plot the prediction of general relativity with gravitational waves on top. And what you see here is not a fit. The data points with very small errors are the data points. And the line on top is the prediction for general relativity. And what I lack here from these two researchers is the chi-square and the probability, you know, but it looks good, right? And especially hypothesis testing, is it zero or is it according to general relativity, gravitational waves? No doubt. So that gives a trip to Stockholm, and that's how actually gravitational waves were suddenly something that people believed in. LIGO has put that one step further. Now we see it as a single pulse, but the fact that things emit gravitational waves was known since actually the 70s because of this jewel of general relativity lying somewhere out there in space. That's it. Any questions or comments on this? There's a question, but not at all on this. The question is if we can share the 110 and 100 hand in. Well, let me just say you're being cheated by the binning, because nobody got 110, but somebody got 105. Let's just get the points. But the binning is from 105 to 110, and so that's actually not a good way of doing the binning. But hey, you have to do some binning. But I would gladly share it if those behind the project say okay to me. So I will simply await a mail from those. And I actually think that there were two groups. So please, general questions, is that okay? They got the Nobel Prize for putting the chi-square value in the plot. Well, they didn't put it in the plot. Without putting the chi-square. Ah, yeah. Yes, they did. But, well, I'm sure it was somewhere in the paper. I hope it was. Are we supposed to have received feedback on reports? Well, you should by now, or at least very soon, have the reports sent to you by mail, with comments and feedback in the report written, Aske. So let me just write that out generally. And those who don't have it, I'll look immediately into why that's not the case. Anybody else who have not had a mail with the report with comments in? Doesn't sound like it. Ah, no comments on report. What? All right. I will look into that immediately. Ethemius, please speak. You had your hand up, but we can't hear you, Ethemius. Ah, okay. All right. I will look. That was the plan for you to have had it, but I see that some didn't. So I'll immediately look into that, and you will have it during the day. And so now we're going to take a break, that's for sure. But afterwards, when it's 10:30, we will discuss projects. If you have any questions, we will discuss previous exercises. If you have any questions, and at the end of today, so the last 15 minutes, 11:45, I'll pull out the problem set and just briefly go through it and take questions if there is anything that's not clear in it. But now we'll take a break. See you 10:30.